I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The amount of gun violence in Kansas City can be described as shocking and horrific, but when an 8-year-old boy is killed in his sleep, words fail. Today, members of the communities facing this threat daily describe the impact it has on them. We'll ask if they feel like residents and their neighbors have a place at the table as city officials and law enforcement seek solutions for the deadly problem. Then, a look at the monuments erected to honor those who crossed the prairies and settled America's West. A professor who has studied hundreds of these pioneer statues says they reveal a lot about how we've constructed our cultural history. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Eight-year-old Brian Bartlett was killed Saturday night in the 8300 block of Tracy when more than 30 bullets tore through his mother's house. Brian had been in bed sleeping. Now volunteers are stepping forward to canvass the neighborhood in an effort to get someone, anyone, to step forward with information about who did this and why. Meantime, Brian Bartlett has become the youngest victim of gun violence in the city this year. His mother is expected to survive, and investigators say Brian was not the intended target. In fact, Brian and his mother are planning to go to the store Sunday to get a backpack for the start of school. So how is the community impacted by Brian Bartlett's murder, and what efforts are underway to combat it? That's our first topic this morning. With us, Damon Daniels, president of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. Damon, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Diane Hirschberger is the Health Communities Program Director for the Marlboro Community Coalition. That's a coalition that works in the area where Brian Bartlett was killed. Diane, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Marquita Taylor is also here. She's president of the Santa Fe Area Council. Marquita, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Damon, this city has endured 90 homicides so far this year. All of them were real people with real families, but this one has to stand out if only because of Brian Bartlett's age. I'm wondering, how are you grappling with this one? How's the community grappling with this thing?
You know, the community is very angry. I'm very angry about this situation.
How can you not be, right?
Yeah, and it seems that, you know, back in the day, there used to be sort of this street code that said women and children are off limits. And it seems that this generation of those who are out here committing these violent crimes have no regard for life, and that street code does not exist. And so for us, you know, especially as a victim service agency, we're seeing this on both sides of the state line where young people are being taken away senselessly to violence, and in some cases by the hands of other young people as well, which is also equally frustrating.
You know, Marquita, I can't help but think that if this can happen to an 8-year-old boy who's sleeping, is anybody safe? Is that feeling out there now, do you think?
I absolutely feel that way. We tend to feel like we're captives in our own homes and in our neighborhoods, and we've struggled.
Captives in our own homes. There's a lot of residents listening to this who can't relate to that feeling, but you say it's very real for a certain segment of our city.
It certainly is. I know that there's certain holidays that my family will make sure that we're down on the bottom floor. 4th of July, those type of things. In the evenings, we know there's
a
cold.
You won't sleep upstairs because you worry that somebody's going to fire a gun and might come crashing through the house.
Yes, absolutely. And that's just become normal for us because that's the environment that we're in. And we just have become accustomed to being very careful about where we go, who we talk to, how do we come in and out of our homes. It's become strategy and a way of life, and that's hard to live with.
I was going to say, that's a level of pressure, that's a level of stress that, again, a lot of people have trouble relating to, but you're saying it's a way of life.
You know, I've seems to, it's really crazy, but we've gotten used to it. It's like we know what we need to do, we know where we need to go, when to go, how to be careful. And there aren't any real safe places that I feel that I feel welcome where I can just go and at any time. That it's just not like that anymore.
You know, Diane Hirschberger, you work in this neighborhood. What are you hearing from the residents out there?
Well, one of the things, the first reaction seemed to be almost people curling up in a fetal position, like, this can't be real. We don't know how to respond. We're so depressed. And after that feeling, then people are saying, what can we do differently? And there's no easy answers to that.
No easy answers.
Nope.
Yeah.
It's very complex.
In what way?
Well, it's complex in that we live in a more violent society in general. The kinds of violence in our neighborhood used to be more on the edge of the neighborhood, and now it's happening sort of as Damon said, you know, it's in the neighborhood more. The shootings were on the main corridors and at local places, and now it's random shootings, gunfire, different times, you know, of the day and night, and it is really bizarre, but you become accustomed to it.
Yeah. Marquita, I can't help but note that you represent an area west of Troost. Am I seeing that right? Or the Santa Fe neighborhood, where does it run?
It's actually 27th Street to Linwood, Prospect to Indiana.
Okay.
So it's pretty geographically in the heart of some
in the heart of the city.
Yes.
Okay. Do we have any idea, Damon, at this point, why these shots were fired into the house? Is there something, is there word on the street what happened here?
There are, the streets are talking about it, but I don't like to speculate too much.
Okay.
Unless I have some facts that may come from law enforcement. But you stated it earlier that Brian Bartlett, the 8-year-old, and his mother were not the target.
Not the target. Okay. Police say they have leads, but authorities are still looking for someone to come forward with information. I'm wondering, Marquita, what explains reticence like this in the wake of the death of an 8-year-old boy?
You know, I as they both have said, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, and we know that it can happen in our neighborhood and has happened in our neighborhood. Not may not have been anyone quite as young, but it's something that we hear and we see all the time. So I just hope. We certainly work with our police department. We work with social service organizations, but we're not able to come up with any answers or real solutions. And our neighbors are really frustrated and crying out for help. In some fashion, in some way. We did a neighborhood cleanup a year ago. While we were cleaning up, a lady got shot. Someone just started randomly shooting, and we all had to run with our brooms while we were cleaning up the corner of 27th and Benton. It's that severe. So
help me understand the reticence here to tell the police information that might help them solve crimes like this. What's that about?
Well, we are actually, we have several neighbors who are coming forward, who have cameras now installed, who are stepping forward and saying, we're frustrated, we're going to get the license plate numbers, and we're sending that information in to the police department, who are taking pictures, and we're doing everything that we can possibly do on our end. So
the community is engaging in a way it hasn't in a long time.
They are, and there are. I'm receiving calls now from neighbors who may not necessarily go to the neighborhood meetings, but they are coming forward and asking, "What can we possibly do?" Because they're so tired, they don't want to move, they want to stay in their homes, they want to raise their families, but it's getting to the place where we don't have an answer. We ask the police department for help. There's just so much they can do, the social services, there's just so much they can do. So we just decided we've got to figure out what we can do ourselves.
Diane, what about this reticence to help work with the police? What are you sensing about what's behind that?
Some of it is that the folks that are committing the crimes are not connected to other people and the community like an average person is.
They're from outside the community?
Sometimes, but I just mean in general, their social skills, their, you know, what happens to a human being is they may not have the same reaction as a typical person because they've found themselves in a situation where dehumanization of life, you know, I mean, that just not as important. They're able to compartmentalize that's not what they're impacting.
Which is a really frightening thing, you're saying.
It's very frightening.
Yeah. I should point out the Kansas City Police Department is still asking anyone with knowledge about the shooting that killed Brian Bartlett to call the TIPS hotline at 474-TIPS. That's 474-8477. There's a $25,000 cash reward, and you can remain anonymous here. Let me go to a phone call here at 816-235-2888. Murad from Independence, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. This is a really, really sad topic that we have to be
discussing and
listening to this morning. One thing that I noticed, and I think might be very important to try to help this, so that we don't get lost in the fog of trying to solve this problem. I heard it being described as certain segments of the city. And then the comment that some people won't be able to relate to this. Well, the certain segment, of course, is the Black and poor communities. Now, people outside of those communities, of course, they can't relate to that. And one of the guests said on holidays, I have to be on my lower floor with my family because, and it's not so much as to point a finger at anyone, but just to make people aware because this shouldn't be happening, but if we're not specific about letting the public know where this happens, the solution to it can get lost in the fog because anyone can act like, oh, well, it's not in my neighborhood, or I don't see it. I have family members who are not far from that location. So I understand it's a bad situation.
Right. Murad, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. You know, Damon, Daniel, with the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, to what extent are police and prosecutors and city officials listening to the concerns of the mostly African-American residents here? Do the residents have a place at the table when it comes to these conversations?
Yes, I believe that they do. And there's several ways, I think, that residents can voice their concerns. I mean, there's in like the 3rd District City Council District, there's monthly meetings. In the 5th District City Council has monthly meetings as well. Law enforcement agencies are usually there. There's, you know, that people can voice those concerns even at Ad Hoc as well. But there are several opportunities for that. There's community interaction officers that are assigned to specific neighborhoods in which if folks are really concerned, they should be going to those neighborhood association meetings, meeting with those community interaction officers as well, and sharing what those concerns are. Just before we came on the air, the three of us were talking about, you know, the Cameras for Good program and how it's difficult to get the neighborhood and residents there to step up to the plate and even just be someone that people can depend on in terms of like a block captain, which is a person that just looks out for others in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, those are some of the simple things that people can do in terms of getting involved in their local neighborhood. And with that comes training as well, but also being connected with law enforcement, too.
You know, Diane, this notion that the neighborhoods and that the local communities have to step up and engage here, I've heard that message from police, from prosecutors, from others. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. And that's that's what's happening in the Marlboro neighborhood where Brian lived. The community interaction officers come every month, 4th Tuesday of every month, to the Marlboro Community Coalition meetings. They give out their cell phone numbers. They respond when anybody calls them.
And you feel that the police are listening to the residents and they're taking them into account here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Marquita?
We have some great support from our officers. They come to our monthly meetings. I'm able to email or text them at any time. And also have a connection with the major as well at the East Patrol. So they are certainly involved. They do attend and they're interested.
Now, I want to go back to a point that Murad made, our caller. How do we get other communities that don't have this problem to relate to the plight of our most violent neighborhoods, Diane? What would you say to that?
Well, I would first say I wish they wouldn't have to. I wish it didn't exist, that that people would have to understand. But I guess the most important thing is to realize that each person's life experience is very different. And what is what a person that lives in a neighborhood where there is violence has this extra layer of experience mm-hmm. that they have to deal with, and the stress that comes with that, and the concerns and the decisions you have to make that other people don't have to make. It's just to learn about that and understand that taking up to a very high level, you know, when the whole city does well, don't leave the parts out of the city that are lowest in, mm-hmm. for example, in the economic income or mm-hmm. those sorts of things. That's why it's important to lift all boats at the same time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the death of 8-year-old Brian Bartlett, who was killed Saturday night in his bed while he slept when more than 30 bullets tore through his mother's house in the 8300 block of Tracy. I'm also wondering, you know, Damon, what is happening to reduce all this violence? We've talked about what the community has been doing. Is the police department doing anything different? Are you seeing a change in tactics, a change in strategy? What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, I want to answer that, but also kind of piggyback off of Diane, which she was just saying, too. I think we have to look at violence through a public health lens. And violence, you know, being that it is a learned behavior, it can spread much like a disease. And so for those who don't live in these communities that are plagued by violence, have to look at the community as a whole, just like a body. Mm-hmm. And if one part of your body has this illness, that will spread. We've seen it in Olathe here recently, with a 13-year-old now being charged with murder. And it is just spreading throughout our Kansas City metropolitan
area. That's the whole philosophy behind Aim for Peace, the group mm-hmm. that tries to stop violence before it occurs.
Absolutely.
Based at the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department.
That's correct. Yeah. So we have to view it as a public health issue. So there are things that the police department are shifting things to. So, for example, you know, we've had the Kansas City No Violence Alliance. I believe it's been around since 2013.
Right.
They have shifted a bit of the focus in terms of doing those call-ins to doing a little bit more focused deterrence with that, and focusing on individuals who had that history, much like they've done in the past. But they're not doing those call-ins as much as they were.
And the call-ins where they would summon people to a meeting. Meeting and sort of read them the riot act, saying, hey, we can help you if you need help, but we're watching. Right.
That's correct.
Right.
That mm-hmm. is correct. And so there's things like that they're doing. I think they're amping up in some ways in terms of looking at how they are connecting with other arms of law enforcement, like when you talk about the ATF and how they are tracking a lot of these firearm related homicides as well, mm-hmm. and looking for trends. But this, for Kansas City and folks that are listening, when you talk about violence, it is so complex. And it's not just one thing that we can be doing. There's several things that we can all be doing.
So
when you talk about making sure that there are alternatives for sentencing, for example, because we also have to look at how we are helping folks who have already done their time get plugged back into civic life and make sure that is not a revolving door. Increasing access to mental health services, increasing access to substance abuse and treatment as well.
And is that happening?
You know, no, not at the level that it should be.
Because the message we get from the authorities is that is in fact happening.
There are organizations out here that are nonprofit that are helping as much as they can and filling those gaps, but they're at their capacity in so many ways.
Those are fairly severe gaps you're describing, serious gaps.
Absolutely. And so when you talk about legislators who are listening to this, we need, you know, so like Medicaid expansion could have helped with making sure that there is more access to mental health services, for example. So there are concrete things that legislators can be doing in that regard. We talk about the issue of firearms and legislating that. You know, we've had 81, and we talk about these 89 people who have been taken senselessly, the homicide. There's been 81 of those have been used, a firearm has been used. And so we have a serious gun problem in our city
that we can't seem to crack with the state's help because of the different philosophy that some lawmakers have about this.
That's
Marquita, when Damon was talking, you were nodding your head about some of the gaps in the system right now when it comes to mental health, when it comes to getting jobs for those who might need to be put back into society. You agree with that?
I do agree, and I do know that the police department has brought on social service champions.
Social workers,
yes, into their, and what they do. And I think, my understanding, it's been most helpful for them. There are a lot of issues where they hope that they will come in before the police have to make an arrest or actually help the family, because they recognize it's the social determinants of health. And it's so important that everybody understands that it's not just what is the cause of the criminal activity, you know? What makes that happen so we can find out some answers, get jobs, we can get the health protection that everybody needs. So understanding that is major to our community, and that may very well be an option.
Vince from Waldo. Vince, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yes, I wanted to go into a solution. I hear these issues all the time.
Right.
Back in the 80s, here in Kansas City, National Youth Sports Program. Beautiful program opened up to all urban, basically they opened up Southeast Fieldhouse. Any kid could come, they could catch the bus at 11 o'clock, come in there and do sports all day long until 6, and then they would feed them a lunch. And it was at that primary age from like 13 until, well, actually, I'm sorry, it was primary age from 11 to like 14. Also, the city also hired youth to clean up around the city, but they would also pay them. And that empowered the youth, because a lot of kids during that time were able to buy vehicles, which, you know, empowered them to go to get other jobs. So whenever I hear these talks, I always hear about the mental health issue. I think that's an answer. But I never hear about financial investment. As a matter of fact, Casey Nova was, you know, defunct this summer. And, you know, I'm not saying that caused that. But ironically, whenever you begin to cease those programs to begin to empower those youth, specifically black kids, they always get unfunded, and then these problems happen, and we're upset, and we don't know what to do. Well, that's the issue right there.
Vince, I appreciate those comments. Marquita, you were nodding your head.
Oh, I have actually said that so many times. Where is the focus on our youth? Where can they go? What can they do? And, you know, when I pose that question, you know, certainly we talk about the Greig Center and other places. And I said, okay, the services there certainly are swimming and there's basketball. What do the girls get to do or have to do? What's the age range? How many people can play basketball at a time? There are no systems set up that are long lasting for the young people. We certainly appreciate Sly James and his summer activity, but that was just a few weeks.
Yeah.
There is nothing for our youth. And until we find out what it is that they want, what they would like to do, and get some things set up for them, I think that's the only answer. But we got to do it.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there, but I appreciate this one a lot because there were several good ideas thrown out here that things that might make a difference. I want to thank Damon Daniel, president of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, Diane Hirschberger, again, with the Healthy Communities Program, program director for the Marlboro Community Coalition, Marquita Taylor, president of the Santa Fe Area Council. Thank you all very much. Stay safe. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks,
appreciate
fans.
It. Yeah.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about monuments to pioneers and what they mean to us today. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Have you received my email newsletter in your inbox? If not, you can by signing up at kcur.org/Kraske. Start your Monday off right with exclusive content from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. It's easy, 10 seconds worth. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, his promising political career was derailed by PTSD. Join me as I spend the hour with Jason and Diana Kander to discuss what motivated him to seek treatment and how his mental illness affected others in his family. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, cities around the country have been erecting monuments to Western pioneers for more than a century. What intrigues even today is what those monuments say about us when it comes to American exceptionalism, race relations, and gender identity. Turns out, they say a lot. University of North Dakota historian Cynthia Prescott writes about all this in her book, Pioneer Mother Monuments, Constructing Cultural Identity. Interest in the monuments to those who suffered hardship crossing the plains in search of a better life has boomed, then waned, and now is back on the upswing. Cynthia Prescott joins us via Skype this morning. She's an associate professor of history at the University of North Dakota. Cynthia, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
I should point out that she'll be speaking at the library, the Central Library at 14 West 10th Street at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. More information at kclibrary.org. You know, what explains, Cynthia, this boom and bust cycle of interest in these monuments over the past 100 years?
Well, the first pioneer monuments really came about as the early settlers started to die off, right? And in this sense, it's sort of parallel to interest today in remembering World War II veterans before they disappear, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There was interest in marking their passing and also interest in Western cities in marking them on the map, essentially, as we're no longer frontier places. We're now civilized cities that are rivaling cities in Europe, or so they mm-hmm. wanted to claim, at least. Mm-hmm. And so pioneer monuments became very popular around the turn of the century. Interest in them waned after World War II as people really turned their attention to other projects, I think. Western imagery, Western mythology certainly was still powerful, right? Western mm-hmm. movies, Western television was hugely popular in the 50s and 60s. But the notion that we should be putting up these monuments to heroic pioneers didn't really mesh well with post-war sort of Cold War ideology in most places. And so mm-hmm. Interest declined, I think, for several decades as a result. But there's renewed interest since initially with the U.S. Bicentennial Celebration in 1976, and people started thinking about American history in different kinds of ways. And I argue there's also renewed interest in recent years amidst the culture wars, that as some places are arguing that pioneers are problematic because they have taken native lands, they have transformed the landscape, they have dominated or conquered the West. Others are said, hey, wait a minute, it's still worth remembering how hard these people have worked, how mm-hmm. hard they have suffered. And I think that's a narrative that's particularly powerful in rural areas that are facing decline and out-migration, the notion that we can look back to our roots and that we're still here, that we're persisting, really has power.
You know, you say, this is interesting to me, the best example of a city actively forgetting about a monument occurred in Kansas City, Missouri, and the Pioneer Mother Monument. Some 30,000 residents attended its unveiling back in 1927. Then it was forgotten. In fact, you had a hard time finding it here in town when you came to visit. Why was it forgotten?
Well, I think interest in the monument really declined along with interest nationwide. And sort of the focus of that place of Penn Valley Park near the World War I Memorial overlooking downtown Kansas City really declined in the post-war period as well, right? A major highway went through the park and divided up the park, and the park space became used in different kinds of ways, right? It became a way through to commute to work rather than a place of civic engagement, I think, in the post-war period. And so Kansas City largely forgot it was there. Trees grew up around it, and even though there was a parking lot and a trail, walking trail devoted to accessing it, you really couldn't see it from the road. You couldn't see it from the nearby softball fields. And so even people who were playing, recreating in the park within, you know, 100 yards or two,
didn't know it was there, right?
Didn't know it was there. You couldn't see it unless you knew to look for it.
How did you find it?
Well, I tried driving around the park. I tried asking people playing softball, and no one seemed to know what I was talking about. I finally had to go back to my hotel room and use Google Earth satellite technology. I knew that this was a massive monument. It's larger than life. It's three adult humans, two horses, right, on a large pedestal. You ought to be able to see the thing. And so you can't see it in person very well, but it turns out that on satellite technology, it shows up pretty clearly. And so once I was able to pinpoint its location on a satellite map, then I was able to figure out how to navigate there on foot or on car.
You know, you say these monuments say a lot about us and our values at the time the monuments were erected. Let's talk about that. I mean, these monuments tend to depict these pioneers as heroic, noble, exceptional, if you will. Should we be surprised by that?
Well, I think this is really representative of American culture, right? We like to think of America, of the United States, as an exceptional place, right? The city on the hill, going back to colonial period, and the stories we tell about the Pilgrims and the Puritans and so forth, right? We're an exceptional people. We pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. These are the kinds of national foundational myths that we often cling to. And so stories of hardy pioneers carving out a life for themselves in an unknown wilderness, that sort of fits with this larger sort of American exceptional narrative. Of course, it carefully ignores a darker side of that comes with dispossession of Native peoples and transformation of the landscape and many other things as well.
What do the monuments say about the role of women back in pioneer days?
Women in these monuments are consistently depicted as, I kind of think of it as Ma from the Ma figure from Little House on the Prairie, books or TV show, right? Ma in a sunbonnet, or maybe Grandma in a sunbonnet. And her role is as nurturer and also as embodiment of white civilization. She's bringing culture and Christian values to an untamed Western land.
Do they tend to underplay their real contributions?
In terms of pioneer women's contributions?
Yes, right.
They do in certain ways. So they put a lot of focus on her as a mother. They're often featured with children, right, with a baby in their arms or a young son by their side. And there's an emphasis on their role as nurturer of their children or nurturer of the larger society by carrying a Bible, say. But if you look at diaries of the time, if you look at the memoirs that those women wrote, they told stories of doing other kinds of exciting stories, if you will, fighting wildfires, helping manage the wagons when you're crossing a river on the Overland Trail, things of this nature. Those stories get erased in the monuments. The monuments consistently depict the women either walking west on the trail or riding west, in the case of the one in Penn Valley Park, or else they have a seated woman who has already arrived in a domestic space in the West, right? The log cabin has already been built. She's seated within it, resting from her labors. She's not seen doing things actively in the way that the pioneer men are seen.
That's interesting. You know, a red hot controversy at the time was whether these women should be seen holding weapons or not. Why was that so contentious? And I believe that the monument on the grounds of the Kansas State House in Topeka, it's called Pioneer Women. I think that woman has a rifle sitting on her lap. Do I remember that correctly?
That's right. So she has a rifle across her lap. She also has a guard dog at her feet. And that was actually a point of controversy when that statue was put up in the 1930s. They had originally chosen a different model by a different artist that featured a woman with a scythe, so suggesting that she was doing field labor, harvesting grain, right, harvesting wheat. That image then became controversial, I think, partly because they didn't want to show that women actually did do field work on the frontier, right, because that wasn't what women were supposed to be doing. Women were supposed to stay in the home, right? But there's also, so there, So they chose to depict, instead, choose a different artist's sculpture, which shows a woman seated. She has a rifle across her lap, but it's clear that she's not in an offensive position, right? She's not going out to shoot a human or to hunt animals. The rifle is there as a sort of defensive pose.
Protection, yes.
It's there for her protection, because if you have a solo woman on the frontier without her swarthy pioneer husband around to support her, you clearly she needs the rifle for protection, was the thinking at the time.
You know, you say in here that while Americans have reconsidered monuments to Confederate leaders, they haven't done so nearly as much when it comes to the pioneers. Why not?
They're starting to in certain places, but for the most part, it has not been, the pioneer monuments have not been so controversial. And I think that's largely because the racial politics of pioneer monuments is more hidden to us today than it is in Confederate monuments, right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy for most of us to recognize that the Civil War was fought in, at least in large part, over the issue of race-based slavery, and emancipation came about with the Civil War, right? So the connection to African-American slavery is really clear in our minds. It was at the time, and was certainly part of the thinking at the time of those statues were put up, but it's something we recognize today as well. In contrast, the pioneer monuments that were put up around the same time in the 1920s and 30s were very explicitly about race. In fact, those put up around World War I or before World War I were even more explicitly about showing white dominance. Hmm. But we don't tend to recognize that today because it was depicted visually in a way that was clear to people at the time. It was spoken about in dedication ceremonies when the statues were put up, arguing that this is about white civilization, about defeating Indian savagery in the language of the time. But that's not something that it doesn't read that way to us today, right? Now we see grandma in a sunbonnet. We don't so much see, oh, grandma in a sunbonnet displacing native culture or native peoples.
Well, I should point out that there's a monument in Olathe that features the only sculptural depiction of African Americans that Cynthia was able to find among the 185 that she studied. More on that is in her book, Pioneer Mother Monuments, Constructing Cultural Memory. Again, Cynthia speaks at 2 on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. Cynthia, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Coming up, Brian and Spencer with your weekend to-do list. What is this? It doesn't make much sense. They sing it like a pop song. You're capable of anything, and I'm surely mad. You could be president, or you could just forgive me. Stopped caring what you think about me. I gave up. We're told we are capable of it. KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him is Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They join us in the studio here each week with ideas for your weekend. Gentlemen, welcome. How are you?
Well, together.
Great. Yeah, Brian, that was the voice of Ben Folds,
yes.
Our oldie but goodie here.
Yes, it's Steve.
He's going to be here.
Spencer and Brian and Ben. Okay, it's Ben Folds. Who is Ben Folds?
He's the
acclaimed singer-songwriter, piano man, raconteur. And we'll get to this in a moment. New York Times best-selling author, would you believe, and so on and so forth. He is indeed capable of virtually anything.
He's a best-selling author, too.
I'll get to that. 8 o'clock Friday night at Starlight Theater.
Wow.
Well, let's cut to the best-selling author.
Please.
Right? Debut memoir. It's called A Dream About Lightning Bugs. And Folds focuses on his life's journey involving his creative process. Get this, it debuted at number 7 like a week or two ago.
No kidding.
On the New York Times bestseller list. Good for him. His concert Friday night, of course, at Starlight. But he will do a book talk. Get this, a book talk and a signing from 2 to 4 in the afternoon on Friday at Unity Temple on the Plaza. And as usual, this sort of thing is hosted by Rainy Day books.
That's amazing.
He's so diverse, you know, pop songs, but also classical music. As a matter of fact, his last album, So There, which kind of sounds like a challenge to the listener, So There, it went number one on the Billboard Classical and Classical crossover charts. Mm. So this is a guy who's pushing himself, pushing the listeners. And he is pushing it because, get this, you've heard of Moscow Mitch, have you, in the media?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, he will probably do, because social media is alive with his rendition of this politically leaning ditty dubbed Moscow Mitch. And perhaps I should just leave it there.
That's Brent Folds, 8 o'clock Friday night at Starlight Theater. Spencer, tell us about the Ethnic Enrichment Festival.
Steve, Kansas City is known for its very rich and diverse food scene, but there'll be no better place to be this weekend than out at Swope Park for the Ethnic Enrichment Food Festival.
And it's a really good festival.
It is wonderful, isn't it? Delicious foods. There'll be mango lussies, lemonades from Scotland.
Mango what?
They call it mango lussies. It's a yogurt-based drink. Yeah. I think if you get out there, that might be one of the first things you should check out.
Yes, that sounds pretty good.
Jamaican jerk chicken. There's also a lot of great activities. Very, very family-friendly, and as you said, always a really great time.
And this is what, all weekend long,
this
right?
This is all weekend long, 6 to 10 tomorrow, 12 to 10 on Saturday, and 12 to 6 on Sunday. So there should definitely be a window for everybody to come out, support, and eat some great food.
That's the Ethnic Enrichment Festival out at Swope Park. What do we have here, Brian?
So maybe you didn't go to Rock and Roll High School.
I don't think I did.
I don't think I did either. But the Ramones sort of did. At least they did by providing the title track to the 1979 cult hit Rock and Roll High School.
Hmm.
But, you know, there's a Ramones tribute concert coming up this weekend. Even though the Ramones are long gone, they were the coolest and danciest of the punk bands
right.
to come out of New York City in the late 1970s. But let's do a little geezer rock alert here, okay? You can go see, well, geezers, for all geezers who self-identify that way. Anyway, you can check out the Rockaway Rejects. That's a Ramones tribute at 9 o'clock Friday at Minibar in Westport. Hey-ho, let's go. A couple of more quick oldies but goodies type things to do. How about Beatles Night at the K?
Wow.
Friday fireworks set to Beatles tunes after the Royals-Mets game at Kauffman.
And this celebrates history that was made here in town, right?
Let me tell you about that. It's celebrating nearly 55 years, that's quite an anniversary, since the Fab Four did indeed play KC's Municipal Stadium on September 17th, 1964, I know it seems like yesterday for some of us, but others maybe not. So go do that real quick. Also, Three Dog Night, or what's left of them, the legacy version of the early 1970s rock and roll chartbusters featuring original co-lead vocalist Danny Hutton and guitarist Mike Alsup. Check them out, 8 o'clock tonight. That's tonight at the Uptown Theater. Joy to you and me, Three Dog Night, Uptown Theater.
Three Dog Night. That idea is just amazing. Yeah. Once a band, always a band,
well,
right?
Well, I guess it's Two Dog Night now.
Is that what it is?
Well, you know. And Chuck Negron, he's the other guy, but he's not in this version. He's out there, too, playing.
All right. It's about a thing. That's Lauryn Hill.
It is.
Yeah.
Now, Steve, a throwback for Brian is in the 60s. A throwback for me is in the 90s. Yeah. Lauryn Hill was one of my favorites growing up. And she's not on the concert circuit too often. So it was a big surprise when Kansas City learned a few months ago that she's partnering with Major League Baseball for Strikeout Slavery, which is a modern movement to spread awareness on human trafficking.
Mm.
And so she will be at Kauffman Stadium on Sunday night, I believe it is, after the Mets game. So it's a big weekend for the Royals music-wise.
She's actually here, Lauryn Hill.
She's actually here. She'll be at Kauffman Stadium, of all places, after the Mets game. So you get great baseball, hopefully, and then you get Lauryn Hill. So beautiful night for all things Kansas City and also great music.
And an important cause, too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Like
What's this, Brian?
What is this, Steve?
I don't know.
Well, let me tell you. Okay, this is hip-hop. We're listening to hip-hop. But we're not listening to the vocal track. We're listening to the instrumental track. This is pertinent because, indeed, we have an event called Trap Karaoke, right? Mm-hmm. And it's happening at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Truman downtown. Huh. This is an interesting event because, get this, it's not. Trap Karaoke is not your typical Holiday Inn bar lounge karaoke. Not to knock it.
Not at all,
right? Have you ever gotten up there and done your thing karaoke-wise, Spencer?
No, but I've seen enough clips and follow along enough to know that it is not quite your grandpa's karaoke.
Okay, this, oh no, that's right. Trap Karaoke is not just, you know, performing to maybe a few semi-interested business travelers grabbing a quick drink before hitting the hay. No, it is about crowd-fueled, high-energy karaoke. It's an extravaganza for the hip-hop crowd.
Wow.
Now, you can go at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Truman. Here's what you can do. Sign up to get on stage if you can, or here's what's fun, vie with others who'll be clamoring down front to be selected as a, quote, wild card performer. So even if it's a four-hour event, okay, it's 8 to midnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's all hip-hop all the time for 4 hours. The only thing I can do karaoke to is the Beatles' You Can't Do That. I don't think that would be well received.
That could be do a Beatles remix. Jay-Z had a great album where he took a lot of Beatles instrumentals and did his rap album that. So there's a lot of synergy and things you can mix and match with hip-hop.
Count me in.
Okay, and finally today. Wild, wild west, when I roll into the wild, wild west, when I stroll into the wild, wild west, when I bounce into the wild, wild west, it's going. Tell us about Third Friday, Spencer.
Steve, looks like everyone has their special day of the week. We've got Crossroads First Friday. We've got weekly events. Everyone wants their second Saturdays or third Sundays. West 39th, one of Casey's best-kept secrets, now has a Third Fridays. We can come out and there'll be a lot of energy, a lot of cool things, boutiques, live music, happy hours, spring collection debuts, summer collection debuts will be on and popping tomorrow at West 39th. And I made one mistake on the last announcement. Lauryn Hill will be here on Saturday, not Sunday.
Saturday, not Sunday. Lauryn Hill to see her out of the K, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's your Weekend To-Do List, sponsored by Spencer Hardwick. You can find his stuff at Wire. KC Weekender and KCUR contributor Brian McTavish. Gentlemen, thanks very much as always.
Always great to see you.
Appreciate it.
Always.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Yesterday on the show, an update on the possible Sprint and T-Mobile merger. Odds are about 50% it's going to go through. Learn how wireless coverage and prices could change for consumers. You can also hear previous conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, I'm spending the hour with former Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander and his wife, Diana, to discuss how PTSD affected the family and his political ambitions. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.